Welcome to Tales of Northern Michigan's Past. I'm your host, Christopher Struble. Nestled between Harbor Springs, Mackinac City, Cross Village, and Lake Michigan, in northwestern Lower Michigan, lies Bliss Township, a small, sleepy community of approximately 538 residents, surrounded by picturesque rolling farmland and heavily wooded hills. Although the area's laid-back atmosphere and overall vibe is perfectly described by the aforementioned name Bliss, the township was officially named after former Governor Aaron T. Bliss. In the 1880s, the area was allocated for members of the Mackinac bands of Chippewa and Ottawa Indians that had been displaced by the early European settlers. As history tends to repeat itself, it was not long before, quote-unquote, American homesteaders also stake claims on these lands as well. More about that story later. Over the last 100 years or so, the area has remained relatively unchanged. Each summer, however, the denizens celebrate their heritage and vision of a multi-generational community that gathers to celebrate diverse music and culture, radiating the feeling of bliss year-round with a weekend-long folk and roots music festival. The event is sponsored and hosted by the BlissFest Music Organization, a nonprofit educational and performing arts organization based in Northwest Lower Michigan. Joining us today to talk more about the nationally recognized organization and festival is founder and executive director of BlissFest organization for over 40 years, Dr. Goodhart himself, Jim Gillespie. Jim's an accomplished multi-instrumentalist. His band's name happens to be Dr. Goodhart's home remedy, hence the odd intro. Good morning, Jim.
Good morning, Chris. How are you doing today?
Well, I'm doing okay. I'm not that big on mornings, but I got to thank you for joining us because even though you are officially retired, your team is gearing up right now, as you stated the other day to me, to turn the sleepy little hamlet of Bliss into a town of about 9,000 music and art lovers.
Yes, it is that time of year again, and we're all getting ramped up for another Bliss Fest. It's officially number 43, although there's two we had to take off for COVID, so it's actually 45 years since the beginnings of BlissFest in 1981.
That's a hell of a run.
It's been a hell of a run, yeah, right. And as you stated, I recently retired a few years ago, but they still...
They can't get you away.
They still rope me into multiple things, and so I'll be headed out to the site today and doing some business out there for sure.
Retirement means Jim's got a lot of free time on his hand. Let's incorporate him into the festival more.
No,
than
means
did.
It means Jim does a lot of work but doesn't get paid for it anymore.
Yeah, that's I'm the president of the Michigan Hemingway Society. I get to cash my $1 check later today.
But it's been a labor of love for me for sure.
So. Oh, of course. I think it meets your lifestyle perfectly, right? And your philosophy growing back. I mean, how old are you, Jim? If you don't mind me asking.
I'm 74.
Young 74.
Yeah, right. So I started the Bliss Fest when I was 29.
Oh my God.
I came back home after 10 years of being. I grew up in Petoskey, and so I went off to school for 10 years. Got a couple degrees, undergrad degree from. Central Michigan University in anthropology. Then I went on to the University of Michigan and got a Master of Public Health. And then I said, the hell with it. I'm not going to use my degree in Lansing and become a bureaucrat. I'm going back home.
Good choice. Good choice.
There weren't a whole lot of opportunities for using my Master of Public Health degree. So I started running the Grain Train Natural Food Co-op. And I tried to convince my mother that I was using my degree. And it took me quite a few years to convince her.
And maybe even, tell us again, as you started, tell us about the humble beginnings of Bliss Fest, which, like you said, started in the in 1981 in your old apartment, which I think was above the original Grain Train, right? Now where Julian Tomatoes stands, is that
yeah,
correct?
Yeah, right. The original Grain Train was at 420 Howard Street, where Julian Tomatoes is. And it was the first retail and storefront for the local food co-op. And I was kind of instrumental in that when I'd moved back. It was just converting from a buying club to an actual retail outlet. And we moved to that location, and I became the manager of the business at that time. And what happened was we got control over the whole building, and we did a lot of remodeling. And the second floor became what was called the Spectrum Center.
Yeah, the Spectrum Center.
And the Spectrum Center was kind of a hangout for the hipsters of the day. And we had dance classes, we had yoga classes, we had a film guild, and people watched film. And we had a kind of a coffee house too. And so people came in and we did an open mic, and so a lot of the local musicians showed up and we played music. And I had, prior to that, when before coming back north, I was kind of involved at the ground floor of the Wheatland Music Organization, which started it, you know, in Mount Pleasant area. And that started in 1972. And I was going to school at that time at Central. And so I was, you know, kind of in on that as a musician and helped organize that a little bit. And so I always had in the back of my mind maybe to do something up north.
You had a little bit of experience already when you came up here, armed a little bit.
Mm-hmm. So anyway.
Now, you were you mentioned Grain Train, so you were part of the getting that kicked off too.
Oh yeah, I was, you know, I was big into the, you know, the alternative hippie.
I was going to say hippie.
Lifestyle.
I don't want to use the word
hippie.
Well,
but, you know, to me, all the good aspects of the hippie lifestyle were like, you know, back to the land movement, you know, organic food.
Take care of each other.
Yeah, and environmental, you know, taking care of the environment. And also, as part of that movement, people were kind of getting into roots music and getting, you know, interested in that type of culture, you know, the old-time music. Was and bluegrass music was just something that I got turned on to when I was at Mount Pleasant by a friend of mine, and I started exploring traditional music. You know, I was always, you know, I played the guitar, and I was, you know, I knew all the Neil Young songs and, you know, Beatles and all that stuff, and then I got turned on to this other music that I'd not been aware of, and it was traditional music, and it was, you know, like Doc Watson and, you know, Nitty Gritty Dirt Band and stuff like that. And so I got real interested in learning that style of music.
And you picked up a couple instruments along the way. I
mean, yeah.
I can't tell whether I want to, when you come to an event, we used to do the Robert Emmett events with George Colburn, and we never knew if you were going to, what instrument you were going to bring, terrapart, mandolin, violin,
right.
Fiddle.
I've always been interested in string instruments, although when I was in high school, I played the trumpet for 4 or 5 years. But I remember when I went off to college, my band teacher actually called my parents and said, your son really should get a music major. He should be in music. He should be teaching music. And my parents went, no, he's going to become a doctor. Music is a nice hobby, but you know, you can't make a living on music. And so, but the music has always kind of been in me, and I somehow went that direction without really realizing it.
Well, at least you had a little bit of encouragement, because I took a musical test in Lansing. They couldn't afford for every kid to have be part of the music program.
Yeah.
So I took the aptitude test, and I was like, I was at the lowest. And I was upset. By the time I was in kindergarten, I was obsessed with guitar, and I spent my whole life pursuing music. So at least you had some encouragement along the way. I was told, this kid should never really partake in music. So
that's interesting. Yeah. So anyway. My band teacher tried to convince my parents that I should be a music major, but that didn't happen. But I didn't become a doctor, and I would have dropped out of college had not I gotten involved in becoming an anthropology major.
So you got a PhD? Is that a PhD?
No, I got a master's degree in public health eventually from U of M.
Okay.
But
that's a great community college.
Yeah, pretty cool community. The experience at Central, you know, really kind of whetted my appetite for learning about other cultures, and you know, and I was always interested in music anyway. So I like to study about different musical cultures, and that got me interested in exploring all the different types of music, and that led to, you know, traditional music and roots music and all this stuff that I'd never heard of before, but started getting interested. So I was kind of learning about the music before we ever kind of developed and invented Blissfest. But it ended up becoming an outlet for me to explore and to share that interest with the community and with other people.
And it's a hell of a form of music too. I mean, you look at these guys, they're players. Like you mentioned Doc Watson, and then you think of like Billy Strings right now. I mean, yeah. These guys are players.
Oh, God.
They're pickers. I mean, they're unreal.
Virtuosos, yeah.
So you got to a good genre of music. May not have been the most popular. Well, it was pretty popular at that time. But
it's sort of been a little bit of a peripheral. Interesting, yeah, you say that. I mean, the popularity of folk music has never been that big. I mean, there was a few folk scares, you know, and... You know, Peter Paul and Mary, yeah, right, and all that, but you know, it'd never been real. You know, it hadn't taken over popular music by any means, but it had its moments. You know, the actual bluegrass and old time Appalachian music was kind of what we started with Blissfest. It was like that was kind of the music that seemed to. Resonate with the young acoustic musicians, you know, and we got a lot of inspiration from elderly music and from the Wheatland Music Organization. So
elderly out of Lansing, Michigan.
Elderly out of Lansing, Michigan had a lot of players that were playing fiddles and banjos. That's where you could go buy it.
That's where I grew up, and I hung out in that, right. All their different
and that's,
stores.
That's where you could go buy a fiddle or a banjo or a mandolin or a guitar. And learn some acoustic music. So the acoustic music craze was kind of, you know, back in the 70s and 80s was on, you know. Mm-hmm. So I was connected with Elderly Instruments and then the Wheatland Music Organization. So we tapped into that musical, you know, the musical, whatever.
Yeah, genre or
right. The music from that area, and yeah. And so anyway, got lost.
No, we just go right from there. So yeah, you just got involved in that music. You start from scratch right there if you want.
Yeah, so you know that was kind of the style of music that the Blissfest started with when we had the first festival, and we brought a couple musicians from Elderly Instruments. There was an all-girls band called the Bosom Buddies that they all worked at Elderly Instruments, and there was an all-girls string band. And so that was like our headliner for the first one. And it was in a farmer's fallow potato field in Bliss Township. And he let us use that. And it was basically a fundraiser for a local school. You see, one of the other guys that helped me start this was Will Michael. And he lived in Bliss, but he worked at the Grain Train. So he was interested in starting this alternative school for all the young kids that they were cropping up there. And so he was looking for a fundraiser for that school. So he came up with this idea, why don't we do a music festival? And of course, he knew I was a musician and that I could help manifest that. So together, we kind of had a committee of two and generated some interest and ended up getting help from a lot of the Grain Train folks, mm-hmm. and decided to do a festival. And we had the first festival on July 5th, 1981, in a farmer's field underneath a maple tree.
Underneath
a maple tree, and we used a 1,000-watt Onan generator. And I think we had about 300 people.
That's pretty good turnout, though.
Not bad. It was a beautiful day, and I think we charged people $5 for the day.
How many performers?
We had, let's see, probably about six or seven performers.
Again, mostly just local?
Mostly local, but our headliner was the Bosom Buddies, uh-huh. from Lansing, yeah, Michigan, East Lansing, Michigan.
I wish I knew. I was a little too young to have known them. I wish I would have been more exposed to the Bosom Buddies somehow.
Yeah, they're great. They were great. I fell in love with a fiddle player and chased her around for a while.
These are the things that happen at these kind of events, right?
Yeah, yeah.
You know, it's funny, you mentioned Central Michigan University as being kind of an inspiration during that period. And so they were big on the arts at that time. It seems a friend of mine, I don't know, did you ever run into Skip Swanstrom? He was an art teacher there during that period.
I remember Swanstrom, yeah, I remember that last name.
Yeah, Skip was, he got busted for growing 400 acres of weed in Central Michigan. So he was never fired, but he was, you know, in the early to mid 70s. That was still a little risque thing to do.
Oh yeah, that was not.
And that was my cool. My best friend's uncle. So Skip's he's still around, and but he taught art on Beaver Island every year. So he was kind of an institution up here also.
Yeah, they have a Beaver Island. They had a camp.
Yeah,
CMU has a facility there
so
for summer.
Like CMU was big on the arts and kind of pushing people into.
Well, yeah,
the,
and they were the NPR station, and NPR
about that.
John Scheffler, who I know quite well, and he was the director of their radio. He did a lot of shows, and was focusing on roots music. And he had the local talent there at first, and then he expanded to national talent over the years. But yeah, he's you know, they've done some programming. They still have a show Tom Ball does called Homespun, and then of course Robert Barclay does a blues show, mm-hmm. and that's CMU Public Radio.
Now they still do a great job. Of course, we got Interlochen too, but you know, with
oh yeah,
CMU,
Interlochen's
you know,
great too. Yeah.
Who were some of your other cohorts in this endeavor? Some, you know, local people as you're getting ready to start this first fundraiser/.
Well, as I say, most of them were part of the grain train cadre of workers. You know, Vicky Joe O'Donnell and O'Donnell Glass family, and Margaret Casserly, and who else? God, I can't even remember everybody anymore.
It's been a little while.
It's been a while, but it was, you know, it was a small group, and we put together, I mean, as I say, there was 300 people at the first one, so I fit everything in. In fact, there's a great picture of me in my Datsun pickup truck with the entire festival in the back, you know.
I gotta see this picture.
It's a great shot.
Nobody remembers the name Datsun either.
Yeah, right. Datsun?
Datsun?
There's a joke around that one. So the first festival was in this farmer's field, Al Reese, who's the supervisor of Bliss Township. And
so it was in Bliss?
It was in Bliss Township the first quite a few years. In fact, I'll give you a quick chronology of the Bliss Township experience. We moved with his fallow field. So the first year, we were at this one location on Garber and Valley Road. And the next year, of course, he planted that. So we had to move. He said, well, you can do the festival again, but you got to move. So we had to move down the road to his fallow field for that year. So we were down the road on Garber Road. And then...
So you rotated based on whatever crop was going to be.
We were rotating with him. We were like these gypsies looking for the promised land, you know. So then the third year we moved to this other location on Pleasant View Road, which was pretty close, about a quarter mile from the store, the Bliss store. And that spot was so hilly and so poor soil that he said we could stay there. So the third year in 1983, we found this location that was, it was a pretty cool location. And so we stayed there from 83 to 87, and then in 87, in that summer, and we started to grow. In fact, we built a stage, and we even put electricity in the ground. We had been running the show there on two generators. In fact, a great story, in I think it was in 85, the very last act on Sunday night, and they were like the last, you know, basically the last chorus and the last sound. All of a sudden, their voices started to flicker and the lights started to flicker, and everything went dark and the crowd went crazy and thought we'd planned it all, but actually the gas had run out of both generators at the same time.
Oh, man.
So the lights flickered, the sound flickered, and it went black. And the crowd was like, whoa, that's incredible. And we looked at each other and went, God, I forgot to put gas in the It was a great finale.
Yeah, it was almost planned,
unrehearsed, but one of those great finales. But so that location was where we held the event from 83 to 87. Well, in August, after the event had happened, and we were starting to get established, we probably had 1,000 people by then, and we get this letter from this guy who owned the property. So we found out that Al Reese, the supervisor, didn't own the property. He only leased it. So we got sued for the first time.
Great. First time.
Yeah, first time. We've been sued a couple times. And so we got in trouble there. So we basically heard about that we were getting in trouble. So we went to the site and we tore everything down one afternoon.
We were never here.
Exactly. We tore everything down. In fact, we pulled the wires out of the ground that we'd put in, and we burned the rest of it and just disappeared from that site, and left no trace, leave no trace.
This is covert, man. We didn't know BlissFest started out as a covert operation.
I tell you, we've been on the run. So, but that was, we have some great stories, but that was a great location. In fact, another great story is when we put electricity in, we were far from the road we were putting it in, and we hit this root, and we had one of these trenchers, and we ground through the root, and we were laying the wire, and then all of a sudden we started seeing these AT&T trucks come by, and they go by one way, and then they come by they kept coming close, and they finally stopped and asked us what we were doing. So, well, we're putting some electrical in, but we were like 300 feet away from the road. Well, come to find out that they had cut the corner, and we cut the telephone line that serviced the entire eastern part of the UP. We cut their whole fucking telecommunication.
You guys start out trying to serve the community, and here you're clipping all of their electronics.
So these guys were there for hours, hooking it back up, getting shocked, and we gave them some. tickets. I mean, they couldn't get mad at us because they didn't have anything. They didn't have any signs.
It wasn't marked properly.
No, they just cut across the field.
Miss Dig hadn't been invented yet.
Yeah, Miss Dig had not been invented.
So after the success of the first one, you guys immediately started thinking about this being a reoccurring event. Is that correct? No? Just
no.
It was one-off?
No, I said after the first one, I'll never do this again.
Famous last words.
We didn't make any money, for one thing. We lost money. In fact, we lost money for the first 10 years. So it was basically a labor of love for all the people involved. I start getting calls in the spring, and people would start to generate some interest in the gathering, because people got excited about having this gathering every year, and the location, everybody loved that area.
Oh my God, you can't do anything, but you can't pick a better place, right?
I always knew that the location was exceptional, and I knew that would help keep it alive. So, the energy would develop and people would volunteer, and without the help of volunteers, you don't get anything done, but we got all these people that wanted to volunteer to help, so it grew organically like that. And in 1988, we actually, after we kind of had to leave on short notice, and the result of that lawsuit was, I think the guy asked for $10,000 and they ended up settling for $150.
That's just a fine?
Yeah.
Just a fine?
Yeah.
When did you guys start acquiring, did you begin acquiring your own property?
Well, that was, in 1988, a friend of mine, Howard Rice, had purchased a farm in Cross Village Town, well, actually Redmond Township, where we are now, on Division Road, and it wasn't that far away. And he invited us to come and, bring what we had extracted from the site and bring it there. And he had kind of a natural amphitheater, and it was an old farm. It was, it had cars and old farm equipment laying around. It was a basic old abandoned farm. So he let us come there, and we leased it during July from him until 1995. So from 1988 to 1995, we leased it and made some improvements, and then in 1995 we purchased it, the original 40. Then we kept adding to it, so now we've got 200 acres.
200 acres.
Yeah, 202 to be exact.
202.
So.
And the music project, I think we mentioned at one point, maybe not on air, but it was originally to fund the school that you guys were working on, is that correct?
Yeah, it was originally to fund the school, and the school, didn't last that long because people moved away, and so they didn't have critical mass to have enough students or enough kids to really make it worthwhile. But the BlissFest kept going.
It's become an institution.
Oh yeah. And so I think in 1988 we became a nonprofit 501c3, mm-hmm. and
board of directors and all that fun stuff.
Yeah, we did the whole thing, and You know, I was the volunteer director for 15 years, and then I think I was a part-time for another 15 years, and then I became a full-time director. I gave up my day job with the community mental health, and that was in 2003 before I actually did a full-time directorship with them.
Became your full-time endeavor.
And we expanded quite a bit. I mean, we grew pretty substantially in the 90s.
That was my question.
Quite a growth curve.
How consistent was the progression of the project? You know, was it the highs and lows? But you say so that during the 90s is when things really kind of...
Yeah, we expanded exponentially and got a lot of growth. And by the time 2001 rolled around, we were sued by the neighbors and the county. And the county.
Now, this for noise violations or just not using it for the purpose intended?
Well,
you know
how provincial people can get.
Yeah.
And so they were afraid. And the Bliss Fest was growing. And we'd gotten to the point where some local folks wanted to kick the hippies out, basically. That's my opinion, and I'm sticking with it.
Yep.
And so we said, "Well, you know, we're gonna fight you." And they accused us of not having proper zoning, and so the county joined them in their lawsuit. So we were being sued by the county and these people we called the interveners. So
you guys were the troublemakers on the block.
Oh, we were, man, we were. And so and there was all kinds of crazy rumors about, you know,
what was going on out there?
Drugs, sex, and rock and roll, you know.
Completely false. Yeah, all of it.
Well, exaggerated.
Exaggerated. Hyperbole.
Yeah. There was fun going on, but it wasn't that crazy. So we had to battle through that, which was quite a growth experience for me and for the organization, and ended up costing $80,000 to hire a lawyer.
Oh, man.
Which slowed us down quite a bit. I was supposed to go full-time, you know, about that at that point in time, but wasn't able to because we spent all our money on lawyers. But we ended up, you know, the interveners made some stupid moves, and so they got in trouble with the judge because they accused us of doing something which we didn't, so the judge took them to the woodshed, and so they dropped out of the lawsuit. Then it was between us and the county. And the judge, Judge Johnson, suggested to the county that we come together and make a deal. And so basically we got together and negotiated conditions of use and basically did what you're not supposed to do, but we did a spot zoning on that property and got conditions of use. And basically, you know, conditions, for example, like how many people, how many paid tickets we could have. And stuff like that.
Is that limit still in place?
Yeah, and we've adjusted it a little bit because part of the agreement was that we could come back and ask for more, which we have.
And you've acquired more property too.
We've acquired more property, so you know we've been good stewards. You know we've met the conditions of use every year. You know it's more like you know proper security, having dust control, not being too loud, not going too late. You know just that kind of stuff in terms of condition.
Not tearing up telephone wires that are going to ruin everybody's phone service.
Right, not trespassing on neighbor's property and stuff like that. And so we've met the conditions of the consent judgment. They call that a consent judgment. And so that was quite a battle, you know, in the newspapers and everything. There's some great headlines and stuff.
And it seems like you're doing such a good thing, you know? It's like no matter...
Well, the bottom line for the county was really torn because they realized that Bliss Fest was bringing in about $3 million on that weekend to jack up the economy of the county.
That's a lot of...
Cultural tourism.
Yeah.
In fact, we even got an award from the state. We got the governor's award for an arts and culture organization in 2003. For bringing cultural tourism to northern Michigan. So, you know, we were getting awards and the county was like suing us. So it was kind of, the county was urged, I think, to settle. So it was good.
Well, and you guys were doing things the way that we, you know, this is even prior to having these signs everywhere to say, you know, leave nothing but footprints, take nothing but photographs. You guys are pretty much leaving no really carbon footprint out there. You're actually doing great things for
part of our negotiations was that we did a conservation easement on a large part of the property, you know, just to prove to them that we were into preserving open space.
Yeah.
Because they, I mean, the rumors were flying out there. The rumor was that we were going to build a Walmart out there. Oh, honest to God. I mean, it got that crazy.
When do hippies build Walmarts?
We were going to do a festival every weekend, and that there was a Walmart was going to go up there.
I mean, this is good stuff.
I mean, it was that crazy.
Now, do you have Walmart as a sponsor to this day?
Yeah,
as
right. Yeah, we should, shouldn't we? Well, I mean, the economy gets juiced really well. I mean, you'd be surprised, like Dunham's, for example.
Yeah.
They have their best
tents.
They have their best
propane
weekend because
grills.
People get up here and they say, I forgot my tent. I forgot my sleeping bag. So they got to go to Dunham's and grab all that stuff.
Yeah, no kidding.
And then, you know, the local stores, they all sell out of beer. And you know, so you know, it's definitely a multiplier in the economy. And the county knew that. So they didn't want to get rid of us, but they had to deal with the locals. And so, you know, the quiet solitude that the locals always talk about, you know, that they want. And so and we're saying, well, yeah, well, we're here for a couple of days and talk about quiet solitude. What about those snowmobiles?
Yeah,
and that's ATVs, some quiet. That's some quiet. Really, what about the guys that are shooting guns off all the time? And, you know, the quiet solitude kind of rings a death ear. But so that was a real growth experience for us. But we got through it. Cost us a lot of money, but then we were able to, start generating a little more money, and we were able to get some headliners and stuff like that. And one of my neat projects, I brought my list, was that I wanted to try to get some of the old, since people thought we were the Woodstock of Northern Michigan.
Oh, I was going to say, the Woodstock name's going to pop up.
Oh, yeah, of course. I started trying to get people who played at the Woodstock.
Well, we know you did, and we're going to get to that story in a minute.
Right.
That's one of my favorites.
Okay. Yeah, we got quite a few. We got quite a few artists that that played at the Woodstock.
Well, I was going to ask you, so who are some of the more famous or well-known
Originally, we were doing bluegrass and old-time music. Then we started expanding into what's called roots music, which kind of, in terms of definition, it's that music that kind of evolved in the United States. American roots music is like, you know, from all the diverse cultures, diversity. Oh, God, I said the word diversity.
Yeah.
But all the diverse cultures that immigrated to America and brought their culture with them created an amazing explosion of music, jazz, blues, bluegrass, country. You know, all that.
Well, a lot of the things they consider Americana music is not truly Americana music, but it was influenced by those people coming.
Yeah, I know. I mean, America generated all kinds of amazing music, right? I mean, we invented
jazz.
We invented blues.
Yeah.
I mean, and it's to the, you know, honor the African Americans that did that. But so the roots music is that popular music, I would say, from like the early 1900s, when we were just starting to have radio, we were just starting to have recordings, and it started to turn into popular music of the day. So that's what we were trying to preserve, that kind of music, because it's still going on today, as you know. And so we were able to start to generate enough money to start to bring in a more diverse lineup.
Mm-hmm.
And then we started expanding so that we were getting more than just Michigan artists, because usually it was just Michigan. Then we started getting more regional, then internet, then national, and then even international. We started even getting into world roots music, bringing in, you know, world music. So that's kind of how I developed the the programming. You know, it kind of started with old time and bluegrass, and then now it's expanded. As you can see now, it's all over the map. You know, we got bands from all over the place.
Who are like some names that pop up? Like, we'll go right to the story. A couple of years ago, there was an incident out there. Richie Havens, who opened Woodstock, had a different experience out at Bliss.
Yeah, well, yeah, but he came back. We had him twice. Yeah, we did. In 1999, I was just reading about it. In my Chronicles of Bliss, we've been writing a history, actually. And he was on stage, and some guy who was high on ecstasy or something came rushing the stage and jumped on it and went right by Richie Havens and went rushing to the back and ran into his spare guitar.
Oh, man.
He had an extra guitar. our insurance took care of the problem, but it was a difficult situation. But Richie came back.
Yeah, he's like, "What the hell's going on?"
He came back 4 years later.
So, and he's now since we've lost him since
right
then.
Right. But we had Richie Havens, we had Melanie, who was at the Woodstock, we had Arlo Guthrie.
Sure.
In fact, we had Arlo Guthrie in 2015, which was the 50th anniversary of Alice's Restaurant, and Arlo Guthrie on his birthday sang Alice's Restaurant at the Bliss Fest.
Well, that's
that was pretty cool.
Yeah, that's cool.
I served him birthday cake. We had Canned Heat. We had John Sebastian. John Sebastian was at the original Hot Tuna. Well, Jefferson Airplane was at the original Woodstock, and Hot Tuna consisted of Jorma Kaukonen and Jack Cassidy, who were part of that band.
Yep.
And then I think those were the main. Oh, Peter Yarrow wasn't. But so those were the main ones that I grabbed before they started all dying on us. But then we've had other. You know, other headliners. We've had Taj Mahal, Nitty Gritty Dirt Band, Los Lobos.
Oh, Los Lobos! I mean, still just something. Those guys are just players, man.
I loved Los Lobos. They were the promoter's dream band. You know, when I was talking to them about getting them here, they said, "Don't worry, we'll get ourselves here." I said, "Oh, that's cool," and. I said, "Does that mean you'll get yourself to the festival site from the airport too? Because a lot of times they make us.
You don't realize
they make us rent a van and stuff."
Sure.
He said, "Yeah, no problem. We'll rent a van and we'll drive up. We're flying into Traverse City. Cool." So they rented their own van. They showed up. They walked on stage. "Oh, you got two Fender Twins. That's all we need." And he looks at me and said, "Jim, you didn't tell me this was a hippie prep festival. I'm overdressed." He has shorts on, you know. "I'm overdressed, man."
That's David.
El Dago.
Yeah.
Yeah. And they proceeded to just rock the place. I mean, they're
killer players, man.
Freaking good. I've wanted them back ever since.
My buddy books them in Chicago. He owns, I can't remember what his company is. Start Bright events in Chicago. He books all the festivals, summer festivals. So he gets bands that are on the way up, on the way down, maybe.
Yeah.
It's like Blues Traveler, Los Lobos.
Yeah.
But David's like you. I mean, you give him anything with strings, and he's gonna just tear it apart.
Yeah. They're such a easy band to work with, which I like. But they were so versatile, and they play the Tex-Mex. They'll rock it out and
killer blues.
Yeah. Right. Oh yeah. Right. So I also really liked working with Canned Heat. They were really great. They were fun. They were a killer blues band, and they brought it. They were good. They were really good.
This is Tales of Northern Michigan's Past with Christopher Struble. Tune in next time as Chris continues his conversation with Jim Gillespie and the history behind Bliss Fest.